I got COVID in 2016 because that fever was nothing I ever experienced. No, I'm not telling you to feel sorry for me. I'm telling you the story. So at 4 o'clock in the morning, so I hear something do this, like trying to open the like our tent. And I went outside and they were like these volunteers and they had these sandwiches with the bread and cheese inside of them. And I was so fucking hungry. I ate maybe eight. And I don't know, I think there is this something like psychological when you connect like a bad experience with food or something. So after that, no cheese for 4 years and nobody believed me. I was like, I don't want cheese. So, oh my God. And then now, like when I see cheese or smell cheese, I'm like, fuck, this is Moria again. Like this is the camp again.
Back to Fractured, our informative podcast about the situation of refugees in the world. And I am very, very happy to announce that today we're going back to our beginnings, because today our podcast is about the situation on Lesbos. For a very long time, Lesbos was the hub of the so-called refugee crisis. Most people who came to Greece crossed Mediterranean and Aegean Sea through Lesbos. It used to be just a hub where people waited for several months and were transferred to the mainland Greece. Then, as an outcome of mainland being full, Lesbos became home to tens of thousands of refugees. The situation on the island is very, very dynamic, and this is what we are gonna discuss today, and we are gonna try to bring you updates from Lesbos regularly. In the studio with me, as always, my co-host, Rashid Galim.
Welcome. Thank you
very much.
Thank you.
And our wonderful citizen journalists who are behind cameras and sound and light. Warm welcome to them, as always, as well. And on Lesbos, two of our wonderful guests, Lorraine Leet, a lawyer and a coordinator of Legal Center Lesbos. Welcome, Lorraine.
Thank you for having me.
And not very far from Lorraine, Silvia Lucibello, who is a field coordinator for Parea Community Center, where, by the way, Refocus Media Labs has also one of its headquarters. And Silvia is also a member of Europe Cares. Welcome, Silvia.
Thank you so much, Sonia.
Guys, let's start with what is happening on Lesbos right now, with the changes that we are facing. Lesbos used to be in the center of news, but predominantly bad news. So whenever something bad would happen on the island, a journalist would come report. It is not that much in the center of attention. Many other things are happening in the world. The situation in Palestine, earthquakes in many parts of the world. So I would like to ask you to give us, from your perspective, so very different perspective, lawyer perspective and a leader of a community center, a little bit of an update on the situation on the island. What are the numbers at the moment? I know it's very bad to start with the numbers, but let's just paint this picture for our listeners. What is the situation at the moment in terms of camp residents, the arrivals, the departures? How is Lesbos at the moment?
Well, I wanted to say thank you, Sonia, for having me here today, because I normally listen to this podcast while I'm cleaning the house in the weekend. So it's really cool for once to be on the other side and to experience it firsthand, even though I must say it's pretty, it makes me pretty nervous, more than I would have expected while I was listening to it while cleaning. But thank you for having me. As you mentioned very well, Lesbos used to be in the public perception and attention as the island of the refugees, and now it doesn't seem so much as a topic anymore, even though I always like to say it's a forgotten crisis, because the crisis is still ongoing. It's unfolding every day. Nobody just talks about it anymore. The lights are not on us anymore. In terms of number, the situation of arrivals has increased a lot in the past year. We had around 10,000 arrivals in the past year, which were numbers we hadn't seen in a long time. And the population of the camp is also growing, especially in the past months over the summer. We had a peak of 3,500 arrivals in September, which was a very, for me, scary number, to be honest, because I hadn't seen it ever. I arrived on the island in 2021 when the peak was already over. And this can clearly be seen in Parea as well. Parea is a community center that hosts 10 organizations and various numbers of visitors. And the number of visitors really reflects the situation in the camp and generally on the island. At the moment, we're having around 700 visitors every day, while we used to have 300, 400 over the spring and 200 last year in the winter. So we could clearly see how the situation in the camp is getting worse. There are more people, there are more needs that need to be met. There are more needs in general for the community, and there is more need for support from our side as well. So absolutely, the situation is growing again, even though we're not talking about it so much. You don't hear it as much as in the past, but it is becoming again a situation which is in a way reminding us of other times, unfortunately.
Silvia, so I'm going to address a follow-up question to you, because in Parea you provide so many different services, but I guess the place where you see the increase of numbers the most is basically the food distribution, right? How is this going right now?
Absolutely. First of all, we in May we had to start an emergency food distribution because many people were not provided food anymore due to their legal status, meaning recognized refugees, which that had received a positive decision, and people with a rejection, so that were not in asylum system anymore. So this was the first situation that was kind of signaling a worsening of the living conditions and provision of basic needs. We had to start an emergency distribution for around 500 people. In the meantime, the numbers started to go down because many recognized refugees started to be transferred to the mainland. But regardless of this emergency distribution, we also provide food every day, lunch every day to our visitors. And we had to constantly increase the number of lunches we ask to our partner to prepare. Because it is never enough. Now we're providing around 350 lunches every day. There is a very long line to receive food, and it never seems to be enough. We constantly have this feedback from our visitors, this complaint that they're really hungry and they want more. Clearly, the food that is provided in the camp is not enough, and the quality is not good either. And this applies as well to other basic needs, such as clothes, hygiene items, washing their clothes, any other basic needs that are covered by us as Eurocares, but also by other very important partner organizations that are supporting us in Parea.
Mm-hmm. So, Lorraine, I'm going to turn to you for a moment to ask you if how is the situation with people actually departing? Are there many departures to mainland from the island at the moment?
Yes, there have been a relatively steady flow of people leaving the island, but not in the same numbers as people are arriving. And I just wanted to comment on that. I mean, we're working in Lesbos, so we know about the situation here. We talk about the situation here, but people who are transferred off the island are not in a better situation once they get to the camps on the mainland for the most part. And many people are being forced not officially, but they're by cutting off food, restricting access to services on the island. People are feeling forced even to pay their own way to Athens, and then they're left living on the streets in a situation where there's now many families, individuals who are living on the streets of Athens because they have nowhere to go, nowhere to register. But I just wanted to comment a bit about the increased arrivals over the last months and the last year. It's difficult to actually count if the arrivals are increasing because of the systemic policy of people being pushed back when they reach the islands. So we don't actually know how many people arrived in Lesbos, specifically the last 3 years, because there's no record of how many people arrived and then were illegally returned to Turkey. So I think it's important to mention that. Not to say the pushback policy has stopped, it's actually continued. And we have been collecting testimonies for people who continue being pushed back even the last months, attacked at sea by the Greek Coast Guard, and left abandoned at sea to be rescued by the Turkish Coast Guard. So I know we'll get into a bit more on this topic later in the podcast, but I think just when we talk about the numbers, we're talking about people who are officially registered. And I think it's important to remember that not everyone is actually officially registered, and there are people who are getting attacked and captured and abandoned at sea by the Greek Coast Guard.
So, but since Lorraine already started with the pushbacks, we were actually interested in the numbers a little bit. I don't know, Lorraine, is it possible at all to speak about some credible numbers of pushbacks? Aegean Boat Report has reports basically every week on how many, not maybe individuals, but usually boats have been pushed back. And the number for October was 380 boats that have been pushed back, which is a really huge number within 1 month. Do you have any numbers to share that we can back up our knowledge with?
Yes, I mean, I think it's important to remember in this context that this is a completely illegal clandestine policy. So it's really hard to get accurate numbers. The Turkish Coast Guard does publish regularly data on boats that are rescued at sea. So this, and they distinguish which are the boats that were pushed back by the Turkish Coast Guard, by Turkish authorities. Of course, this is just one source. And it's not good to rely on one source, which also has its political motivations for showing violations by the Greek state. But what we have found over the last years, and as an organization, we've been documenting pushbacks in the Aegean since 2020. What we've seen is that when we are taking testimonies of people regarding specific incidents of pushbacks that they survived, we're able to corroborate that their testimonies by testimony from the Turkish Coast Guard. So it does seem like this evidence that they are publishing is reflective of what's actually happening at sea. What's not reflected in this data is people who go missing at sea. And we know there's many cases of people who are never found again, and we don't know what happened to them, and there's no data on these people. So I think it's important to keep both these things in mind when trying to collect data. But what we can say is that the evidence we've collected from testimonies we've taken is it does seem to be reflective of what the Turkish Coast Guard is publishing and also Aegean Boat Report.
Are people allowed to, for example, some people were taking boats and saving people from the sea. Are they allowed to do it like individuals? No. And if they do it, no. I remember one woman went to jail for it. I think it was an Italian lady. She was saving a lot of people and she went like to jail for it. Wow.
Well, what has happened over the last years has been a steady increase of criminalization. First of migration, so I think it's important to note that it's always migrants who are facing criminalization more than those who are in solidarity with migrants and people on the move. But there have been several court cases as well brought against people working in search and rescue. So I think you're referring to there was a case of a search and rescue organization and people associated with it in different ways who are facing serious criminal charges who still haven't been brought to trial, actually. There were a few individuals who faced some time in pretrial detention who have now been released. But they've been waiting to go to trial to prove that they're not guilty of the very serious charges against them since 2018. There have been announcements by the police that they've conducted investigations, that they've uncovered supposed criminal organizations involving NGO members, that they've supposedly uncovered smuggling networks involving NGO members. But these cases, we haven't actually seen any criminal charges come out of these cases. What it seems like to us is it's more a tactic to create a climate of fear so that people are afraid to intervene, are afraid to be in solidarity with migrants who are facing very serious violence by part of the Greek authorities. And this is also happening in a context where this systemic policy of pushing people back at sea started. So, of course, if no search and rescue vessels are allowed, and this is, I won't get into the legal, specific legal provisions, but essentially the Greek state has made through legal provisions have prohibited search and rescue activities, except in cases where organizations are registered with the authorities and receive a specific order to assist Greek authorities in a rescue operation, which means that if they don't have that specific order, they're prohibited from doing so and can be prosecuted. So that is essentially means in Greece, there are no search and rescue organizations operating at sea, which has allowed for given free rein to the Greek Coast Guard to do what it wants to people who are trying to cross and arrive to Europe.
Mm-hmm. Sylvia, Lorraine, also a follow-up question on that. I know that you are also defending people who have been accused of human trafficking. For example, people, refugees, who were forced to steer the boats to bring people to the island. What is their situation and how difficult is it to legally defend people who are in this situation?
Just a clarification that the people who are accused of driving the boat, they're charged with, normally charged with facilitating illegal entry or smuggling. So it's this distinction legally that's quite important because trafficking often involves taking people across borders against their will, whereas smuggling is, you know, assisting people in crossing borders that normally they want to cross. So I think this distinction is important. But what is happening is that people who are themselves asylum seekers, who are themselves trying to get to Europe to seek protection, are being accused of this and are facing very serious criminal charges. And imagine people arrive to Greece, they're arrested either immediately in the Coast Guard vessel where they're rescued or upon land once they're registered with the police. And so they're brought to the police station, taken to the court for questioning, and sent to prison, pretrial detention, without knowing the language, without having access to a lawyer who can explain what's going on to them. They are assigned a state-appointed lawyer, but often the state-appointed lawyer doesn't have an interpreter. The person doesn't have any contacts in Greece normally. So what's happening in most of these cases is that they're being tried very quickly and convicted without even knowing what's happening to them. We have been able to take on the representation in several specific cases, but it represents a very small fraction of people who are actually facing these charges. In Greece, the second highest prison population is people who are facing smuggling charges or who have been convicted of smuggling charges. So this is after people who are in prison for drug-related offenses. The second highest population after that is actually mostly foreigners who are in prison on charges of smuggling. So this is a huge problem in Greece. But it's actually based on European Union regulations on anti-smuggling legislation, which has a very broad definition of what constitutes smuggling, which is then applied against migrants who end up touching the steering wheel on the car or the boat that's crossing into Greece and then find themselves with these charges. The UN has a protocol on anti-smuggling, which says very clearly that if someone is themselves a migrant crossing a border, or if someone is providing humanitarian assistance, that this cannot be considered smuggling. But this is not reflected in the European regulations. And then what ends up happening is thousands of people are being imprisoned for this. It's actually over 2,000 people in Greece right now who are in prison on these charges.
It's a crazy. I just want to say that this is crazy that this is the second most most like common, I don't want to say crime, but like most so many people are in jail for this specific activity. You really shocked me. I was not aware of this fact.
I remember when I sorry
Rashid.
I remember when I arrived in 2016 in Lesbos, the first question that they asked us when we got out of the boat, who was operating the boat? And do you know who people, like, they are like refugees, they operated so in, like, from the Turkey, like from Turkey, like the smuggler, he tells you if you don't have money, they will teach you how to operate the boat and you go for free. So many people, they don't have money to pay, so they do it and they teach them right on the spot. A friend of mine, he taught him like 5 minutes before, like do this. And we were lost for 4 hours. And when we arrived, we were dead. We were hungry. We were like really many people that were dying. And they asked us who was operating. And we just, and we were like, no, we are dying. We don't know who was that. And some of them, they said, no, he threw himself in the water. So we saved my friend. Otherwise, he could have gone to jail, really.
Absolutely. And this is, of course, the first thing they want to know, right? Who operated the
boat? We were dying and they were like, who was operating? Like, I don't know.
But, you know, it's always like it's the most vulnerable ones, right? If you say like people who do not have money, they will be forced to steer the boats, right? So you're already in the most vulnerable situation and they put you basically in an even worse situation.
Yeah. Can you imagine that?
Yeah.
If I may add on that,
yes,
on the point of in general criminalization of migration and solidarity to migrants, I think what's also very interesting is that anyone would also be criminalized in the case we go to the shore and try to give some water and some food to someone who had just arrived on the island. And this is something that is not so uncommon anymore. Like, it does happen that people arrive very close to Mytilini, to the place where we live, to the beach where we are maybe swimming and having fun in a weekend. And I find it really crazy. And the level of dehumanization of people, that you can't even give some water to someone that has just arrived after crossing the sea in those conditions, is really madness. I mean, we also heard of NGOs that have been threatened not to give any food to people after they received a negative decision because they become clandestine, they become irregular migrants. So we're really speaking about the most basic needs here, not just rescuing people in the sea, but also offering them the most basic needs once they arrive on the land, which is also our work. And it's part of really the most human and ethical kind of codes we can follow. So I think it's really crazy how much and what's the extension of criminalization in general, dehumanization of migrants, that they're really seen not as humans in need of any kind of solidarity or support, even the most basic one.
I want to encourage everybody, if I may, I want to encourage everybody who is interested in this topic to check one of our episodes in season 2 when we spoke to Sean Binder. When he was just before his trial, talking about what actually happened the night they were arrested and how they were shocked, how they couldn't believe it, because they were also cooperating with the Hellenic Coast Guard. So they would normally, like when they were just observing the sea to see if any boat is in distress, they would usually notify the Hellenic Coast Guard to help and rescue. And being arrested for suddenly trafficking, smuggling, was a huge shock for them. So his story is very powerful. It's the beginning of season 2, I think episode 2 of season 2. So I encourage everybody to check it if you're interested in it. Lorraine, back to you.
Yes, I just wanted to add on Sylvia's point that this has also affected legal actors on the island. So for the past 2 years, we've been providing emergency legal assistance to people who are arriving to the island. And what this means is people who arrive and they're still afraid that they'll be captured by the Greek authorities and sent back to Turkey. So in the last 2 years, we've actually provided assistance to over 2,000 people who were able to contact our office in order to provide them assistance so they can access the asylum procedure, which is their right. And in doing this, of course, we're in close connection with the authorities. We inform the authorities about the arrival of boats, and in doing so, hope that we can protect them from being pushed back, that a lawyer on the island knows that these people are here and knows that they want to seek international protection, which is their right. But there's several legal organizations on the island. We're the only one providing this assistance. And this is likely because there's this fear that even legal organizations can be criminalized just for being in contact with people before the authorities know that they're here. Even though it's everyone's right to contact a lawyer, this is something actually that's been confirmed recently by the Athens Bar Association, who published an expert opinion confirming what should seem like an obvious fact, that everyone has the right to access a lawyer, including unregistered migrants who want to seek asylum. But this is the state we're at in Greece, where even in a few months ago in Thessaloniki, there was a lawyer who appeared at a police station with an interpreter to provide legal assistance to migrants who were being detained there. And he and his interpreter ended up being detained themselves under suspicion of smuggling, just because they had a awareness that these people were there and wanted legal assistance. They were released, but I think this shows really how this government will do anything to continue its policy of pushing people back to Turkey, because this is really at the basis of what's happening here, is that those of us who are trying to intervene to protect people's rights are now finding ourselves under under pressure and under suspicion of criminal activity, when all we're doing is actually acting as lawyers and providing legal assistance to people who have every right to that assistance.
And even if people are detained and released, it really injects fear in people that for just helping, just showing some goodwill, they can be simply having massive problems in Greece. With this note, we're going to take a short break. And during the break, you will hear a little bit from one of our partners. So we'll be back in a few minutes.
Paria Lesbos is a safe space for people on the move, especially residing in the refugee camp on Lesbos, but also more generally any members of the local community that might be in need. And first of all, Paria, as the name itself in Greek means, is a community, a circle of friends, a company. For us, Paria is a space where people can come freely. They're always welcome. Our gates are always open. And they can find a place where people stand in solidarity with them. Not only they can have access to basic needs, education, psychosocial and legal support, but they can also, first of all, find a place where people are there to listen to them, to support them, and to remind them that they are people, first of all, before being refugees, migrants, asylum seekers, or any other label that might be used to describe them. We want to remind them, first of all, that they are human beings, and as such, they deserve care, love, and attention like anyone else.
Right after the break, I want to go to the situation that happened today, actually, on Lesbos, which was the protest of the Eritreans in the camp. And we only know what we read on some short notes and information that our students on Lesbos sent us, that the Eritreans are forced to be registered as Ethiopians. And they decided to protest against that, also the situation that they are waiting very long in the camp. So, Sylvia, Lorraine, I would very much like you to tell us a little bit more about this very unusual and strange situation.
Yeah, I can jump in first unless you want to, Sylvia.
No, you can go on.
Yeah, I mean, today's protest wasn't the first protest of this kind. A few weeks ago as well, there was a protest by the Eritrean community for the same reasons. And actually, this is something we had noticed with some of our clients, that they were having their asylum claims rejected on the basis that the Greek state had found that their nationality was Ethiopian, even though they're Eritrean. And I mean, I'm not an expert in Eritrean-Ethiopian history and political context, but what I know from our clients that we've represented is that many people were forced to leave Eritrea because of ongoing civil conflict in the country, and had spent most of their lives in Ethiopia. So they grew up in Ethiopia. They didn't have identity documents because they fled, as often happens, and so they don't have any documentation proving their Eritrean nationality. Neither Ethiopian nationality, because they don't have Ethiopian nationality. But the Greek state is then using the fact that these people are more familiar with what's happening in Ethiopia to assume that they have a nationality which they don't have. This is quite serious, also in a context where, just going back to numbers a little bit, over 95% of people of Eritrean nationality receive international protection. Ethiopia, I don't have the latest numbers because this is something that has been quite volatile and changing over the years depending on the situation in Ethiopia. But what is certain is that the number of people receiving protection as Ethiopian nationals is much lower. So what this in effect means is that these people will be denied access to international protection and will be subject to arrest, deportation, if that ever happens, and denied access to the protection they deserve. And I mean, what we saw after the last protest is when some representatives of the community finally were able to speak to the asylum office representatives, they essentially told them they threatened to have all of these people sign a paper saying they're Ethiopian and said, if you don't sign this, you will be rejected. Of course, this is completely illegal. And they didn't follow through with this threat, the authorities, because they know that it's illegal, but it still created this this sense of uncertainty and lack of protection in the camp, which has continued, and which is why we saw people going out to protest again today. I mean, there's a lot more I can say about problems in the asylum procedure, but just like an after impact of it, just to say that this it's not just these people who are protesting who are impacted, it's also everyone living in the camp, because what happened when these protests happen is the police surround the area, they prevent people from leaving the camp, which is related to the fact that the camps have become more and more militarized over the years. I know we'll get to this a bit later with the new camp that's being built, but essentially this camp that exists in Lesbos is already a heavily militarized zone, which the authorities can close anytime they want, which they did for almost 3 years straight during the pandemic. And now it continues to be a place of privation of liberty with heavy surveillance of the authorities, where people describe it as a prison because that's what it feels like, knowing that the government has this amount of control over people's lives and their ability to live their lives freely.
Sylvia, is this also what you see in the community center? I assume nobody from the Eritrean community really came today because of the protests, but we heard that also the gates were closed for people. Did you see less people in your community center coming for services today because of that?
Absolutely. Today we had like 150 people, which is a very low number compared to our normal numbers. And from my understanding, there were also other people from other communities that joined the protest, also complaining generally about the living conditions of the camp and the long wait in the asylum procedure, with interviews that are scheduled for summer 2024. So very, very long waiting times, and generally complaining about the whole situation, the living conditions which are getting worse and worse, especially in the last months. And this is clearly affecting our work every day, because today we didn't have many visitors, but also because clearly our visitors come to us and they see us as a place where they can really open up and ask for support. They know that they are safe there and they can really share their needs. And we keep on hearing this, that the living conditions are getting worse, that they need more help with basic needs, but also more support in terms of legal support. And they feel really powerless towards this situation. So I believe it is still very positive that there was a peaceful protest and that the communities came together to express how they felt and the injustice of the system and the situation. But as Lorraine very, very well said, they just closed the gates and there was no possibility for anyone to go out. So potentially also vulnerable people that had appointments or that wanted to come up to Parea to get any food, nobody was allowed to go out. So heavily militarized and securitized kind of camp, which is more and more similar to an open air prison.
This issue, I noticed it also in 2016 when I arrived there. So when we arrived the next day, we had to go to this office and we get a paper so we can go to Athens to apply for asylum, because at the island there was no asylum office there. So if you go to this office and you say, I'm from Syria, they have this huge book and they bring the part of Syria and they have like pictures of the money, pictures of the flag and questions mm-hmm. they ask you. Even if you provide your passport, they want to see, so they ask you. A friend of mine, he's from Sudan, and he answered all the questions right to get his paper that he's from Sudan. The interpreter told the guy there, he told him his skin is light, he's from Egypt. And he got refused, they didn't give him his paper. And he was screaming there, like, he speaks the same dialect. He answered all the questions, but the guy had a different opinion. He said, no, he's from Egypt because his skin is lighter. And this guy doesn't know that people in the north of Sudan, their skin is lighter than the people of the south. So he was, and he stayed there, and they push people to buy these fake papers. For example, if I have this paper, I can make photocopy of it and I can sell it. And they sell it to up to 150. They make a lot of money, Syrians there. So if you have it, some of Syrians, they stayed there to have this business. So you have this paper that allows you to leave Athens, but they stayed there and they sell it every day. Every day, maybe you have like 10 people. You can get even to like 3,000 euros from people and you're staying there. So they push people to do this kind of stuff. It was horrifying.
There's a whole system that is basically broken.
Can I just add briefly on that as well, the role of Frontex in the registration and the identification procedure, because it has been Frontex supporting the Greek authorities specifically in the registration of people's biographical data, including their nationality. So it has actually been Frontex who's been systematically registering unaccompanied minor children, for example, as adults, registering people with incorrect nationality. And these are decisions which are very difficult to overturn once they're registered by Frontex. And Frontex itself, it's very difficult to... they have a complaint mechanism, which is... it is not very transparent how it works. There's very few cases of actually a complaint mechanism going through and having people have their rights recognized. So this means that many people are having incorrect data registered by Frontex, which then impacts their futures.
Mm. So, Lorraine, what is happening with people who get rejected? If you could like lead us through the asylum process. I know it has been changing. The rules have been changing a lot. I remember when I arrived and you guys actually provided legal training on asylum services. And I remember that at the end, the guy who was leading the training, he said, like, I just want to make sure that you understand that whatever I told you now in 2 months may not be valid anymore. This is how fast it's changing. So, but if you could give us some kind of a brief overlook of how the situation looks like right now and what is happening especially to those who get the second rejection?
I mean, of course, we're talking about people who managed to register. So leaving aside everyone who was pushed back to Turkey, unofficially deported without actually being able to apply for asylum. So people who actually register, the first hurdle people face is an admissibility assessment, which means, and this is something that's been in place since the EU-Turkey deal in Greece, this... political decision really by the European Union and then implemented by Greece, saying that Turkey is a safe country for people who pass through there on their way to Greece. And so since 2016, it's been an assumption of Greek authorities that everyone from Syria, all Syrian nationals, and at first it was all Syrian nationals who didn't have a recognized vulnerability, would be rejected on the basis that they could return to Turkey. This was expanded in 2020, the beginning of 2020, to include all people regardless of vulnerability from Syria. And then it was expanded further in 2021 to include all nationals, not only of Syria, but of Afghanistan, Somalia, Bangladesh, and Pakistan. So obviously, Turkey doesn't have special protections for people of these nationalities. It just happens to be the largest number of people arriving to Greece are from these nationalities, which shows again that this is a political decision of Greek authorities. So the situation now is if you arrive to Greece from any of these countries, there's an assumption that Turkey will be safe for you and you'll be rejected just on that basis without any consideration of what happened to you in your country of origin, why you left your country of origin, and what could potentially happen to you when you return to Turkey even. This has changed a little bit in Lesbos in the last couple of months, but I don't want to talk much about it because this is only a change in the last few months and we don't know if it will be something permanent, where they're actually accepting people now who are coming from Afghanistan, who are coming from Somalia and Syria. But we don't know if this is due to the influx of arrivals and the lack of official deportations to Turkey, or if this is something that will continue. But the overall government policy, and this is confirmed through a joint ministerial decision from the Ministry of Migration and Asylum, is that all of these people should return to Turkey. Aside from that, people of other nationalities have to go through an interview procedure, often without legal representation.
where it's assessed if these people are eligible for international protection. International protection is based on, I don't want to get into too many legal things here, but just to summarize, is you have to show that you have a well-founded fear of persecution in your home country due to your identity, or that there's a very serious risk that you will face serious harm if you're returned. What this means is that already people eligible for international protection, it's a limited number of people who are crossing borders for many different reasons. It's an exclusive migration policy to limit who is eligible for international protection in this way, without recognizing all the different reasons people are migrating due to climate change, due to family connections, due to economic necessity. And then there's, on top of that, all of the different problems in the asylum procedure itself, where even people who would meet this narrow definition of who's eligible for international protection are not able to show it because of how these interviews and decisions are made. I mean, we have several clients who, for example, have legitimate claims for refugee status based on sexual orientation, gender identity, who are being rejected because the person making the decision doesn't believe them. And this credibility assessment, as they call it, is something very subjective. And imagine you have to show something that's so personal and integral to your identity, and then have your case rejected because one person who's making a decision doesn't believe you. So this, of course, and the psychological impact of this is it's difficult to describe, but what it means is that there's many people who are having their cases rejected for reasons that even fall outside of who should get international protection, including people from Syria, people from Afghanistan, people from Somalia, who otherwise, if they're somewhere else in Europe, would receive protection, are getting rejected. People are getting rejected because of biased assumptions about risks in different countries. So people from Democratic Republic of Congo, who are facing internal conflicts for years, are treated the same as people coming from other conflicts that maybe are better known to the people making these decisions, like in Syria or in Afghanistan. So there's a whole lot of layers to the problems people face, but in the end, what it means is that people are being rejected, rejected on appeal, and then they're stuck in Greece, and they're sometimes even stuck in Lesbos. Since March 2020, there haven't been official deportations. Stop me if I'm going on for too long.
No, it's actually interesting.
A long time, I don't want to bore the audience.
No, go ahead.
Yes, since March 2020, there haven't been official deportations from Greece to Turkey. And what this has meant is that people whose cases are rejected on appeal, they're not arrested and deported normally, although there have been some cases of arrests, but they are without status, and as Sylvia mentioned earlier, they're cut off from access to any services. So they're being cut off from access to food, but also medical care, to cash assistance programs, and often they're stuck on the island, so they still have geographic restrictions, so they're not able to freely travel to the mainland Greece, they end up often feeling like their only option is to apply for asylum again. But they're applying for asylum again to an authority which has already rejected them. So it creates a system where people are just forced through this procedure, which they're likely not going to have a different result. And then, interestingly, in the last few years, there was also an additional fee placed for people who apply for asylum a third time. So now, if you're rejected twice, when you apply for asylum again, you have to pay 100 euros for every person in the family. So you can imagine, especially now that the asylum procedure has been accelerated for many people, they arrive in Lesbos, their case is rejected within a few months, they apply again, their case is rejected again a few months later, and then when they apply the third time, if you're a family of six, you have to find 600 euros to make that application. So this is also a huge money-making program of the Greek authorities as well.
Is this how they're trying to fight the economic crisis?
Oh my God. Lorraine, what
they've
about...
They've already received plenty of money from the European Union for their migration policies, so...
Do we know anything about the voluntary returns, like people who really want to go back? What happens to them?
There are still encouraging people to sign up for this voluntary return. So this, I mean, I guess if you were in 2016, you probably remember that IOM,
yeah, I remember.
After you arrived, but IOM is one of the first organizations that people see when they arrive. So imagine you just cross the sea, and then the first person you talk to is someone offering you to go back to where you came from, as if this is an option for you after you've just risked everything to cross the sea. So this is still in place. We still have people coming to the office saying that I was offered this amount of money if I agree to go back to my home country. So this for sure is still happening.
To finish this episode, we have two requests to our listeners. First of all, if you either listen or watch us, because you can watch us on Spotify and YouTube, please give us a thumb up or comment or something. This allows us to fight the vicious algorithm. That would be really nice of you. And the second very important message that we would like to pass on you is that many NGOs like Refocus, like Parea, like Legal Center Lesbos, it's the end of the season, it's the end of the year for us, so everybody is in a fundraising mode. And as sad as it is, we have to really fight for every donation we're getting. And those donations are spent really smartly. So we would like to encourage all of you who care about the refugee cause to donate to one of our organizations. In our show notes, you will find links to our fundraising campaign, to a Parea fundraising campaign, to Legal Center Lesbos. You can choose whichever cause you care most about. Maybe you care about more than one cause. We encourage you to do so. If you feel like maybe you can resign from one coffee a week and send this recurring donation to the refugee cause, it would be highly appreciated and well spent. Thank you very much, and we will see you in 2 weeks. After the fire of Moria, Dag was helping with everything there in the field, but I broke my foot, so I couldn't do much. But I was responsible for a fundraising campaign and buying products for our students and their families to make sure that they're getting some kind of a food. The food was not delivered for the first 3 days. I think water came after the 3 days, and then food like the next day. So I was trying to find things that have calories, right? So that it's just lasts longer. And I was buying a lot of cheese because I thought cheese has calories and I'm addicted to cheese, so it's delicious. Why not? And I remember Yas at some point telling me, "So it's so great. We really appreciate it. But can you give us something else than cheese?"